Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places with your host, Adam Bronstein.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. If you're listening via web browser, I encourage you to close out of that, pick up your smartphone, head over to your favorite podcasting app, and search for Wilderness Podcast. Look for the green logo with the bear. There you can continue on with this episode. You can hit subscribe to catch new releases, and you can go through past episodes. A reminder to my listeners that any views expressed on this program are mine and mine alone, and do not necessarily reflect any organizations that I am involved with. In this episode, I interview Christopher Ketchum, author of This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. Now, Chris and I did an episode specifically on his book last time, so you can scroll back through the past episodes to listen to that one. In this episode, we talk about mountain bikes and wilderness. And before I jump into the episode description, I just want to read a review on his book. This is from Jeffrey St. Clair, editor-in-chief of Counterpunch. This may be the most important book about the American West since Edward Abbey's Desert Solitaire. And like Abbey before him, Ketchum refuses to go down without a fight. This Land is a code red alert for what's left of the West, an urgent howl to join him on the front lines of the only war that really matters, the war against life on Earth. Nearly every page burns with a ferocious rage at the mutilation of the landscape that shaped the American character. So if you haven't read Chris's book, I recommend picking up a copy. It'll open your eyes to all sorts of issues out there that you might not have ever considered. On this episode, we talk about mountain bikes and wilderness and the threat of Senate Bill 1695, which would amend the Wilderness Act to open up wilderness areas to mountain biking and other forms of mechanized recreation. This is a full attack on the Wilderness Act. We talk about the recreation industry's grip on self-professed environmental groups, discussing the Wilderness Act and the ban on mechanization, impacts of mountain biking and other recreation on wildlife populations, allowing mountain bikes in wilderness as a slippery slope, recreation capitalism, recreation as a distraction and a societal pacifier, and fighting for wilderness values. Well, I hope you enjoy this program. Chris and I had a great chat. We cover lots of ground. And I hope that after listening, you'll reach out to your senators in opposition to Senate Bill 1695. This is a complete disaster and just flies in the face of the spirit and intent of the Wilderness Act. Howard Zanheiser must be rolling over in his grave. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in and enjoy the episode. Christopher Ketchum, thanks so much for joining me back on the program. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and hear what you are thinking and have to say.
Hey, man. Good to be here.
Well, we've got a lot on our mind right now, our minds, I should say. We've got the Senate Bill 1695, which is to amend the Wilderness Act to allow local federal officials, I'm reading the actual text here, to determine the manner in which non-motorized uses may be permitted in wilderness areas and for other purposes. So this didn't just come out of nowhere, but industry has been working to open up wilderness for mountain biking for quite a while, but it just recently got a hearing, and my understanding is it's going to be voted on before the end of Trump's term. He's also said that he would sign on to it. So we'll talk about bikes in wilderness, and then we'll also talk about just the general recreation scene. A lot of people are now referring it to recreation for good reason, and we'll just have a chat all about it. So what are your thoughts about bikes in wilderness?
I think we should use caltrops to stop them.
Caltrops?
Have you caltrops? Have you not heard of caltrops? They're wonderful little devices. All right. So in medieval Japan, when a ninja assassin that committed his heinous crime was trying to escape his pursuers, behind him he would drop caltrops, which were a type of metal, little tiny metal spiked ball, right? That no matter how it fell on the ground, there'd always be one spike poking up, which is very effective to pop the tires of mountain bikers. Instead of cows, we have caltrops. Yes. Yeah, I'm totally against it, this idea of mountain bikes in wilderness, primarily because it runs in the face of the language, the intent, the spirit of the Wilderness Act, which bars motorized and mechanized transport from wilderness areas. So what this bill, though, really amounts to is a continuation of a long erosion of the Wilderness Act that's been ongoing for, you know, more than 30 years in terms of creating exemptions and little pieces of legislation here and there that say, all right, well, this wilderness, we're gonna allow the use of motor vehicles to repair, this fencing, or we're gonna allow motor vehicles to enter the area to rebuild a historic fire tower. Numerous instances where Congress has stepped in and through the process of death by a thousand cuts has been stabbing at the Wilderness Act. So this is not new, but the bigger problem is that mountain biking itself is such a big industry and is an activity, quote unquote, enjoyed by so many people that the moment you do open wilderness to mountain bikes, they will flood in. I guess we'll get to talking about that later in our conversation. But when you have floods of mountain bikes in wilderness areas, there are negative effects on wildlife.
And as we talked about earlier, wilderness, some of the only places that wildlife can go. And a lot of times, you know, we hear the expression rock and ice, and those are the last remaining places that are relatively undisturbed. And of course, industry is okay with giving away rocks and ice because there isn't much timber to extract there. Wildlife also depends on low elevation areas, like we talk about all the time here on this program, in the Gallatin Range, and why those two drainages are so important. So, you know, there's really no place left for wildlife to go and to not be really harassed. And it's not on purpose. You know, people aren't going in to harass wildlife, but studies have shown, and I will link some studies under this episode page that showed just how profound those impacts are to wildlife, whether it's direct encounters and, separating mom and cubs with bears, or it's just the general displacement and herd migration alterations that happen when you just get absolute floods of humans going through these places. So we really owe it to wildlife. We owe it to ourselves to give them the space. And let me just say that I've said numerous times in this program, I am a mountain biker. I just don't think mountain bikes should be allowed in wilderness. And I should not, my riding should not impact others of this world that really deserve their own space. I mean, we've got, 2% of wild animals left. We should extend everything we can to them.
Yeah, that's right. Now, with regard to the Gallatin Wilderness, you know, the reason that there's any controversy there is because you have the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, the Montana Wilderness Association, and the Wilderness Society all advocating for cutting up the Gallatin Range and sacrificing those lower elevation drainages that are so important to wildlife so that mountain bikers and snowmobilers can have access. So the wilderness areas in the Gallatin would only be the wilderness areas would not include those pivotal wildlife corridors, lower elevation, mid-elevation wildlife corridors. So I think that's something we should talk about.
Yeah.
On the line. Why do you have self-proclaimed putative environmentalist defenders of the wild, such as the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, the Montana Wilderness Association, and the Wilderness Society, playing a game to erode wilderness areas to satisfy the interests of recreationists? Now, Adam, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's complicated, but the corporate influence and foundational influence has a very strong factor in all of this. There's basically an understanding that to receive funding, that groups have to work with other interests that are anti-wilderness, and they form collaboratives. And we need to do a collaborative episode on this program at some point to really yeah. get at all the details, because it's really complicated. A lot of it is shrouded in secrecy. But you know, these groups have basically, dare I say it, you know, sold out and are no longer putting wilderness first all of the time. So you have just these compromises that result in further erosion of our wildlands and wilderness study areas and our future wilderness. So, you know, it's a real complicated thing, and but that's the unfortunate reality we live in today. But, you know, industry has its grip on everything. Neoliberalism has run its course. I don't know what else to say.
No, it hasn't run its course, man. It is.
It's just getting going. Totally. It's just getting going.
Running its course, you mean we're seeing the end of it? No, man. It is dominant and needs to be toppled. So I have before me a crib sheet from the Corporate Accountability Project that's sourced in part from wrongkindofgreen.org and sourcewatch.org, which talks about, it presents itself as a continuum of types of organizations affecting environmental matters. And so the Sierra Club and the League of Conservation Voters are considered to be moderately compromised environmental groups, quote-unquote, somewhat compromised or directed by foundation or even corporate funding. But of the highly compromised environmental groups, right, those which are basically are set up or funded by foundations with corporate-friendly agendas, you've got the Wilderness Society, you've got the Environmental Defense Fund, and then totally corporate-controlled environmental groups, the Nature Conservancy, right? So both the Nature Conservancy and the Wilderness Society are they are the allies of recreation. They are spearheading the whole program of collaborative wilderness legislation, in which wilderness values are indeed sold out in order to compromise with anti-wilderness interests. So the problem is, aside from, you know, voices in the wilderness, Wilderness Watch or other similar small grassroots, you don't have real advocacy for wilderness anymore. You just don't have it. The people with the power and the money aren't there to defend wilderness. So case in point, right? The Senate bill that would send the mountain bikes like a Trojan horse into wilderness areas, well, not a word of discouragement is heard from, you know, the Wilderness Society, the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club. I mean, Adam, have you gone through, has anyone spoken out of the major enviro orgs?
Let me just say that I haven't done an extensive, exhaustive search. Okay, so, you know, there could be something out there. But I did a general perusal of social media and websites, and I didn't see anything. Now, I've seen past articles from the Wilderness Society, you know, talking about how mountain bikes don't belong in wilderness. But that was maybe a couple of years ago. I haven't seen anything on Senate Bill 1695. But again, that doesn't mean it's not there. Okay, I just want to make that very clear. I was sort of jumping around. And so let's talk about the Wilderness Act a little bit. I just kind of want to lay this out for folks. And, you know, there's a little bit of philosophy here. And I just want to talk about some of the founders of the Wilderness Society and also the architects of the Wilderness Act. But let's start with a quote from our mutual acquaintance, Scott Silver. He says, "Wilderness is a place. Wilderness is a place, a path, and a portal through which those who are willing to throw off their encumbrances are able to connect with their humanity." He says, "When Big W Wilderness is treated like Little W Wilderness, and Little W Wilderness is treated like parks, and parks are treated like playgrounds, the battle for the wilderness will be lost." So Scott's talking about this whole slippery slope idea. And when he talks about little wilderness, that's de facto wilderness, basically undesignated roadless lands or any other lands in wild state. The Wilderness Act came out of a period of enlightenment during the Great Society and the environmental movement of the 1960s. There was a lot of great thinking going on in those days, and it would be a shame to disregard the underpinnings of their philosophies and reasoning. Apparently, we still have learned nothing. And let's get to the Wilderness Act itself. So, the Wilderness Act reads, "To secure for the American people of this and future generations the benefits of an enduring resource of wilderness, statutory designation of wilderness areas is necessary. Congress said in order to assure that an increasing population, accompanied by expanding settlement and growing mechanization, does not occupy and modify all areas within the United States." So here we get at the topic of mechanization, which ties right into mountain biking. And I'm just going to say a few more things, and I'll turn it over to you. The Wilderness Act also talks about being untrammeled by humans. So wilderness generally appears to have been affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the imprint of man's works substantially unnoticeable. So that's a quote from the Wilderness Act. So we talk about the imprint of man's work. Well, bike tires make a big imprint. We also have the opportunities for solitude or a primitive and unconfined type of recreation. So just reading through all that, Chris, I mean, it's very clear, and there's a lot more we can talk about, historically speaking, and some of the thinking of the early wilderness thinkers, that bikes just do not belong in wilderness.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, tell that to the so-called advocates of the wilderness. So let me take a moment. Plug my book, man. I got to plug my book. So the book that I published in 2019 is called This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. And I just read a little snippet here about the Wilderness Act. I go so far as to say the Wilderness Act was an astonishing event on par with the Endangered Species Act, an anomaly in the history of the United States. It expressed values fundamentally antithetical to the dominant American ideology, which assures us that with more mechanization and more technology, we will, in the end, occupy and modify all places necessary for continued growth. Such a civilization holding fast to the manifest destiny of limitless expansion cannot have wilderness, because wilderness represents a limit. You shall go so far with the trammeling machine and no further. Right. So, you know, the language in the Wilderness Act is very clear. It talks about growing population, growing mechanization, and occupation of the land. Right? So we're talking about, you know, 1964, the authors of the Wilderness Act foresee that we're going to live in a country where you got too many people expanding into too many places with machines. And we had to basically, you know, put a sword into the soil and say, you're not going to go any further. That's it. We're going to preserve some of these places from the expansionist machine. And I think that is, as I wrote in my book, that's an incredible event in the history of American law. Incredible event. It's a wonder it even passed, really. So,
yeah, it really is incredible looking back on it. So we have to look back at those days. We have to look at what these folks were thinking, why the Wilderness Act came about. And it's not like our population has decreased. It's not like our resource demands have decreased. Wilderness is ever more relevant today. In fact, I talked to a couple mountain bikers the last year or so, and I've heard twice from people, and they said that wilderness is antiquated. And I just found that to be
antiquated.
Yeah, I found it to be completely oxymoronic, as if you could improve on wild nature. Like there's something that human progress can improve upon our wild places. And this is sort of the mentality that I'm hearing out there. Not by everybody, of course, but the diehards who want to have access to wilderness.
Well, and the diehards are represented by IMBA, right? The International Mountain Biking Association. This is a group that would have us clear out all, you know, wipe out all wilderness regulations and cut down all the barriers to bikes going anywhere they want. So what do you expect from the hardcore mountain bikers? They're alive with their, you know.
Yeah, they're being fed. They're being fed industry propaganda, right?
Right, right. I mean, I don't know. I used to live in Moab, you know, full of mountain bikers, and I found that most of them are just dingbats. They didn't know a goddamn thing about ecology. Didn't much care, and that viewed their experiences in the backcountry of the desert as one of adrenalized excitement, like little children, you know, or like people doing drugs. So that was just my experience, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see much hope in converting that crowd to a wilderness ethic, frankly.
Sure. And you can be a mountain biker and you can be a wilderness lover. Like these aren't mutually exclusive. They don't have to be. You don't have to take a really hard side here. I mean, you know, let's just leave some places free of domination where we can.
So, you know, we should talk about some of these studies that have come out regarding what recreation or the effects of recreation, mass recreation specifically, on wildlife and on the health, the vibrancy, the viability of wildlife populations. So just in general, there's some stuff that I've been looking into. These are studies conducted over the years regarding outdoor recreation and its effects on wildlife. So, 1998, you've got a guy named Scott Miller, a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who found that, quote, increasing evidence indicates that these activities are, in fact, not benign. On the contrary, data suggests that outdoor recreation can affect wildlife individuals, populations, and communities. Now, in 1995, an evolutionary biologist named Dr. Karen Losos surveyed all the factors driving the decline of threatened and endangered species listed under the Endangered Species Act. And Losos was shocked to find that outdoor recreation, both mechanized and not mechanized, was one of the leading causes of species extinction. All right, fast forward to the year 2008. You got a report in Bioscience Journal. The headline, Quiet, Non-Consumptive Recreation Reduces Protected Area Effectiveness. That same year, 2008, researchers in Northern California were taking a look at mammalian reactions to recreationists and came to a startling conclusion. Quote, paired comparisons of neighboring protected areas with and without recreation revealed that the presence of dispersed non-motorized recreation, so dispersed non-motorized, right? So talking about mountain biking, hiking, skiing, right, led to a fivefold decline in the density of native carnivores and a substantial shift in community composition from native to non-native species. All right, and it goes on. Shall I go on? Let me go on, please.
Yeah.
All right. 2016, a team of researchers at Colorado State University review all available studies worldwide on the harmful ecological and environmental effects of recreation. Their most important finding, quote, counter to public perception, and that's key, counter to public perception, because we don't think of this as being bad. We're hiking through the woods, we're jogging, we're riding our little bikes. Counter to public perception, non-motorized activities had more evidence for a negative effect of recreation than motorized activities. Which is crazy. I mean, totally shocking to me. Snow-based activities, this is for another quote from the report. Snow-based activities had more evidence for an effect than other types of recreation. And then the authors went on to note the problem of over-visitation, specifically in national parks, right, in the U.S. warning that, quote, protecting biodiversity from potentially harmful effects of recreation is a primary concern for conservation planners and land managers. So, again, this is all counter to public perception, because as I was saying, we're riding our little bikes through the wilderness and we don't think, oh, this is harmless. This is harmless. You know, we still haven't figured out, researchers still haven't figured out why there were non-motorized activities would have a more negative effect than motorized activities. We don't know. And so there was a report that you sent me earlier today, right? From the University of British Columbia's Wildlife Coexistence Lab. There's a report that's just out. And the lead researcher said that, confirmed, quote, that recreational activity is displacing wildlife. And further, the lead researcher, Cole Burton, adds, mountain bikers are doing it more than hikers and horseback riders. But he adds, quote, we don't know why. And the way they set up the study is they put they set trail cams and then watched wildlife behavior, motion-activated trail cams, and watched wildlife behavior, how it changed after certain recreationists, or after, you know, a mountain biker passes, a hiker passes, a horseback rider passes, and then gauge the reaction of whatever wildlife was caught on camera. So there's an article in Bike Mag that says wildlife stayed away from cameras after people passed by, whether they're, you know, hikers, motorists, but for longer periods of time after specifically mountain bikers and motorized users. And again, we don't know why.
It is what it is, right?
The overall evidence is clear that recreation is having a negative effect on wildlife. But, you know, the outdoor industry has sold us a lie that this is all harmless and green and it's all fine and dandy.
Yeah, it's all about having fun now. And unfortunately, wildlife was never mentioned in the Wilderness Act. There's a brief mention of ecosystems, but that was definitely a shortcoming. But there was just so few people and disturbance that they probably didn't need to consider it as strongly as if someone were to just start from scratch today. You know, wildlife would be very high on the list. I just want to read you a paragraph I wrote here. We can have technological civilization and we can have wilderness, but they must remain separate if either are to survive. Allowing mechanical transport into wilderness is antithetical to the wilderness idea and gives into growing cultural attitudes of domination, which are inherently self-destructive. The philosophy behind the wilderness idea calls upon us to show humility and restraint. Allowing machines into wilderness is a clear assault on these values. By meeting wilderness on wilderness's terms, it opens doorways to humbleness and meaning and moves one past the adolescent singular drive to have fun at any and all expense. And this sort of ties back into recreation and the push for industry. I've got a couple quotes here from Howard Zannheiser, one from Zannheiser, one from Leopold. Quote, wilderness will not survive where there is mechanical transportation. It kind of lays it out pretty clearly. This one's from Leopold. Recreation is valuable in proportion to the intensity of its experiences and to the degree to which it differs from, in contrast with, workaday life. By these criteria, mechanized outings are at best a milk and water affair. I could read a whole section here from the Wilderness Institute. It, you know, talks about Marshall, and, you know, it's real interesting that Zannheiser and some of the other architects, I mean, Zannheiser wrote it, but he had a lot of influence, right? He didn't limit the text to motors. He specifically called out mechanization. You know, Benton McKay, Aldo Leopold, Bob Marshall, all these guys talked about the threats of mechanization. So, you know, this is a very clear and dangerous and radical shift from the Wilderness Act. And I think people need to understand that. This is truly a slippery slope, and we haven't even mentioned e-bikes yet, which we need to get into.
Yeah. I wrote a piece for Sierra about e-bikes. not long ago.
Yeah, I read that, and it was spot on. Do you want to talk about e-bikes a bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're awful. You know, I mean, it's like, takes all the fun out of biking. The whole idea of biking is supposed to be using your own power.
Yeah, what was that quote about lazy and flabby Americans riding in national parks? I forgot that was someone quote. You quoted somebody in your article.
That's Crystal Music, who's and that's her real name, Crystal Music. She's a ranger in seasonal ranger in Utah, and she said that e-bikes are just quote another toy for fat, lazy Americans to fight for the increased, their quote unquote, increased access to our public lands when they already have millions of motorized roads and trails. So,
yeah.
But the larger picture is that, you know, in December, there was a coalition of environmental nonprofits that filed a suit to stop the National Park Service from allowing e-biking in the parks. And what the suit said was, the use of e-bikes, quote, creates qualitatively new risks, such as high speeds, increased likelihood of collisions compared to non-motorized bicycles, and the startling and disturbance of hikers, runners, and horse and traditional bicycle riders. E-bike use also causes environmental impacts, such as increased noise, trail damage, and disturbance of wildlife. Yeah, e-bikes suck, man.
It's like this progression of just getting lazier and easier, right? I mean, hiking's hard. Biking, like, just in terms of miles traveled. And we have mountain biking, and now we have e-bikes. It's like we're losing that connection and the work you got to put in to really reap the rewards. Like, it's just that instant gratification, satisfaction hit that just seems to consume the American mind. I don't know.
Yeah, but you're going to be charged with being ableist, man. You're ableist. Because what about, you know, crippled folk out there and the handicapped and the elderly? What
yeah.
about them? Don't they deserve to get on an e-bike?
Yeah, just not in the wilderness. If I'm paralyzed tomorrow, I will not want to have access to wilderness. And, I mean, motorized wheelchairs and regular wheelchairs are actually allowed in wilderness now. There was a suit under the ADA, I think, so they're allowed in now, which I have no judgment on. You know, that's I have no judgment on that. Another thing to consider as well is people be able to bring in carts. So, you know, those little trailers that people hook onto their mountain bikes? Can you imagine people like riding up into the Wind River Range with their all their gear and their beer and whiskey and having not packed it in
America,
they can
with your keg.
They'll be able to trailer in a keg into the Cirque of the Towers.
Yeah, right on. Well, okay, so you were quoting Leopold earlier, right?
Yeah,
right, Aldo Leopold has got a great line about the recreation industry. He writes, gadgets fill the pockets. They dangle from neck and belt. Mm-hmm. The overflow fills the auto trunk and also the trailer. Each item of outdoor equipment grows lighter and often better, but the aggregate poundage becomes tonnage, which is great. It's so spot on for the recreation industry today. I mean, I remember once I was wandering around Canyonlands National Park, the Needles District, and I turn a corner and there's some dude with like a million gadgets hanging off of him. He's got this huge pack and endless stuff, man. And he looked like Inspector Gadget. In fact, he was a fan of Inspector Gadget because I started talking to him. He's from France, and in France they've got this weird thing about Inspector Gadget. I don't know if you know this. It's like
some kind of fetish.
The French have loved Jerry Lewis and Inspector Gadget. And so he's like, why? Je suis comme Inspector Gadget, huh? And because I speak French, right? I lived in France for many years. So we're going back and forth. We start babbling on and on And I thought to myself, there it is. The aggregate poundage becomes tonnage, man. This guy was weighed down. So, yeah, people like their toys and the recreation, and the outdoor industry, the recreation capitalists, they love feeding them the toys, right? So the Outdoor Industry Association, Patagonia, REI, Kelpie, the North Face, the whole bunch. They love it. When we consume more junk and bring it into the quote-unquote wilderness.
Creates a barrier. It's a it's a separation. I'm trying to find the right words. Also, with the the push for recreation, I was thinking about this the other day. It's really this big pacifier that the Forest Service likes to promote, because they can keep a few big trees along the trail, and most people don't venture beyond the trail. So you could you could have a nice little corridor, maybe a couple hundred feet of old growth, and then beyond that, it's all logged, because no one's gonna go check it out. So recreation.
It's called the beauty strip.
A beauty strip. Yeah.
Seriously, it's a beauty strip, man. So that people bike along, walk along, and they're like, oh, what lovely trees. Then you hike a little bit back in the woods. It's all clear cut devastation.
Yeah. Yeah, the beauty strip's nightmare. Like along roads, right? Like they'll leave right. some trees there.
And along trails. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very smart, very cunning, those Forest Service people.
And the infrastructure really concentrates people, right? So you got your nice parking lot, your facilities, your nice trail. There's nothing to see beyond here. Don't look beyond the trail. Don't see all of this ecosystem destruction that's going on. Just enjoy your beautiful recreation.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Another study about recreation. This is from 2019, Colorado State University wildlife biologist Bill Aldridge looked into the effect of hikers, skiers, and snowshoers on elk populations near Vail, Colorado.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And so Aldridge states, quote, to measure the impact on calves, we deliberately sent 8 people hiking into calving areas until radio-collared elk showed signs of disturbance, such as standing up or walking away. The consequences were startling. About 30% of the elk calves died when their mothers were disturbed, an average of 7 times during calving. Models showed that if each cow elk was bothered 10 times during calving, all their calves would die. When disturbances stopped, the number of calves bounced back. Well, there you go.
And there's a whole herd of elk was decimated.
Yeah, in the Vail area, right?
In the Vail area, yeah.
There's an article in The Guardian on this, in which a Colorado wildlife manager was quoted saying that with continued trail building and expanding recreation, which is what you got in the Vail area, well, that area is going to become, quote, a biological desert. But you won't hear that, Patagonia, REI, Kelpie, the North Face, or their associated, quote-unquote, conservation groups like the Outdoor Alliance and the Conservation Alliance. And you won't hear that from the Outdoor Industry Association, because they're all implicated in profiting from, effectively, wiping out local elk populations so that people can go hiking, snowshoeing, and skiing.
Right. We can't limit the resource, right? Can't limit access. It's all about access.
Can't limit access, right.
Access. You can't.
Human carrying capacities. No one talks about human carrying capacities. It's what we need in an overpopulated earth where everyone is footloose and carbon entitled, and everyone wants to go everywhere all the goddamn time. Well, then you need to establish limits. And you need to say, nope, this area has a carrying capacity of 10 people per year, or whatever that carrying capacity might be. And that carrying capacity has to be determined by biologists and ecologists, not politicians, not industry groups, not stakeholders. No, it has to be people who actually understand land health, biodiversity, wildlife behavior, and wildlife health. That's the only way to do it. Will it ever happen? Of course not. This is America.
Yeah, just like biologists and ecologists are left out of those collaboratives, you know? Like anyone speaking up for wildlife or biodiversity, they're not even invited. They're not invited.
No, and when they are and they speak up for the things that they know so intimately about how this collaborative compromise program, this compromised wilderness is actually going to start wiping out local populations of wildlife, well, they're escorted to the door because they're not collaborating, you see. Scientific truth. By speaking scientific truth about the effect of compromising wilderness, they are dismissed.
Here's a scary thought. So there's always unlikely bedfellows in the quote-unquote conservation world, right? And that's how these collaboratives get together. Mountain bikers are in cahoots with loggers because if an area isn't protected as wilderness, then they will have access. So now what we'll see, which is just absolutely unbelievable, and, you know, I could be a conspiracy theorist here, but you'll have natural allies now with the Wilderness Society and IMBA, right? It's all about getting those wilderness acres on the map. So now if mountain bikers can get access, you've got this greater coalition fighting for wilderness, and they'll get more acres, they'll get more marketing and promotional material, they'll get more fundraising.
That's right. That's right. Yes, there's those little notches in the belt in which they say to the public, we protected 10 million acres of wilderness this year. Well, okay. Is it actual wilderness that protects that is in accord with the Wilderness Act? Does it actually protect biodiversity? Does it protect any of that? Does it enshrine any of the values of the Wilderness Act in that particular area of land that's supposedly protected?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, if you see an alliance between the wilderness, if you end up seeing an alliance between the Wilderness Society and IMBA that then results in passage of compromised wilderness bills, well, the answer is no. Those wilderness areas are not going to reflect the true values and spirit of the Wilderness Act.
I mean, grazing is always, we talked about grazing plenty, but, you know, that's always been a use allowed in wilderness, but you know, you see in the Owyhees, right? Like we mentioned, we talked about this, but those areas aren't real wilderness because they have so many damn cows in them. So if we're going to keep eroding our wilderness values, and this just isn't wilderness anymore. You know, so many places already just really aren't wilderness because of cows and floods of people and wildlife disappearing. So what is wilderness anymore? If we don't have that baseline, how the hell are we going to recognize what actual wilderness is?
It's a marketing tool for fattened, lazy, narcissistic eco-professionals. That's what it is.
Thanks for the reminder. Well, man. Yeah, I mean, this, you know, I don't know if the next step is e-bikes. In wilderness, I'm not a lawyer. You know, they define non-motorized travel as the term non-motorized travel means a method of human travel that does not use a propulsion, internal or external motor with a non-living power source. And
so
I don't...
You're talking about the 1964? You're talking about the 1964 bill or the...
No, we're talking about the amendment.
Senate Bill 1695.
Yeah, 1695. So I don't know if because there's a non-living source as a human, then that overrides any classification if there is an internal motor hidden somewhere. Like, so I don't want to start telling people definitively that this is going to open it up to e-bikes, but I just don't know the answer to that. But it's clearly, if this passes, even if it doesn't pass, like, it's been getting closer and closer. It might pass in the next couple of years. And I just don't have faith in Congress enough that they truly understand the meaning and intent and the history and the philosophy of the Wilderness Act. There's a few of them in there. I don't know how outspoken they are, but we've lost so many champions, and it's because of this corporatization that they just don't need to know or think that they care to know. So it's just this gradual erosion. Like you said in your e-bike article, it's a very slippery slope. And we're sort of on the cusp now. Wilderness Watch is doing an amazing job. They put out an action alert. I'm going to post that link on this episode page. I've already shared it on Twitter. And write your senators and tell them mountain bikes don't belong in wilderness.
Yeah.
I mean, this
and
is
remember,
a full attack.
Caltrops. Just get your Caltrops out.
Caltrops, yeah.
Caltrops, pop those tires, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be happy if I see mountain bikers in wilderness. I don't think I'd be able to keep my mouth shut, you know?
Pop the tires, man. Then have to walk it out.
That's direct action.
Direct action. That silly little machine, that little masturbatory machine. Yeah.
Oh, what else is on your mind, Chris?
Oh, civilizational collapse. But let's save that for another time, man. I got to put my daughter to bed.
So I just want to close with talking about recreation as a wilderness value. And there are so many other values to wilderness that are not discussed. And that's because they're not pushed by the status quo. We have aesthetics, the sublime, spirituality, finding one's humanity, clean water, clean air, biodiversity, ecosystem integrity, wildlife, carbon sequestration. It goes on and on and on.
Mm. I was just going to quote Don Hazard, you know. He told Congress, I think he told Congress, maybe this is an essay, I quoted my book, that something like, we work for wilderness preservation, not primarily for the right of a minority to have the kind of fun it prefers, right? And then he goes on to say something like, recreation is not the dominant use of wilderness. It
yes.
should not be the dominant use of wilderness. And that's the guy who wrote the Wilderness Act.
And then he goes on to say that that there shouldn't be any particular use at all, right? He said that specifically, that this there should be no specific use of wilderness. And all we can talk about is recreation. Hell, we're not even talking about recreation. We're just talking about the fun, go have fun kind. And there's nothing wrong with having fun.
W-R-E-C-K.
Recreation, yeah. There's nothing wrong with having fun. It's just... look at the bigger picture. It's such a small part of meaning and the values that wilderness provides all of us. And we have to keep fighting for this. Otherwise, we're going to lose it. And people got to start thinking for themselves and not just take the line from what you're hearing out there, because it's coming of a place of profit motives.
Damn right. All right, man, I got to go. I really do. I've got to get my kid to sleep.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
I think I think we covered some good stuff here. So thank you.
All right, bud.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.